Hello, I'm Andy Burnerman, and welcome to Sparks. This week, fixing your washing machine, Teletext licenses up for auction, shortwave in the United States, a recording of Queen Victoria's voice, TV AM squeeze foldback audio into the NICAM carrier, and more news on Century, Ireland's former national commercial station. Some other bits and pieces, and of course your letters. That makes up Sparks, every week on Monday and Tuesday on Radio Fax, 6205 and 12255. And now for the winter in the UK, 3910.
We want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand.
Yeah.
Here's a letter from John Braden, writing from Lehman in Germany. He starts with a reception report, including a rebroadcast of Radio North Sea International from 1974, a tape of Radio Caroline from September 1990, and then a report of airport news from the archive programme. This was really boring, he writes. This first segment was well worth tuning in. I like hearing particularly good replays. Then things got pretty monotonous with the airport reports. They're terribly boring, aren't they? And mouldy oldies. If I like the oldies, I'd buy the CD rather than trudge through fading and static crashes. I want something I can't get anywhere else. Well, some people like the oldies. Obviously not John Braden. I'm using a Sangian ATS-803A and 40-metre dipole. I live in southern Germany, south of Kaiserslautern. I moved there a year ago from the United States, where I tuned in several pirates. I'm a physician contracting with the Army, and I very much enjoy tuning Euro pirates. Good luck. Well, same to you, John. And he writes, later, further on down the page, about Sparks. Heard your programme of Churchill's speeches, review of the CFA, the Crossfield Antenna, and letters. Format was greatly improved. Very interesting material. Thanks very much for that, John. So, moving on to something from The Guardian. Do it yourself. Bubbles and squeaks. Gareth Parry with cures for ailing washing machines. Washing machines are probably the most overworked household electrical appliance. Most have had at least a year's warranty, some have a 5-year optional extension. If this is the case, fiddling about may void the warranty. Sorry, but you'll just have to wait all day for the engineer to call. Service manuals with new machines sometimes have helpful diagrams of various parts. Like humans, older models can behave badly in a number of ways, one of the most common being a refusal to drain off the water once the final rinse cycle is over. You may be able to get rid of most of it by turning the programmer straight to spin and drain. If you can't, prepare for a flood with lots of newspapers on the floor and containers at hand. Never, ever look into a broken machine before disconnecting it from the electricity supply. Switching off at the plug is not enough. And if you really can't figure out how to disconnect a fused switch unit, then turn off at the mains. But remember, the most usual case of a stalled machine is a blown fuse in the plug. Check the fuse and connections within it, as well as the ones to the appliance itself. After disconnecting the power, turn off the water supply, usually red and blue hosed taps leading into the machine. Haul the machine out from under the work surface. Remove the back and check the filter for drachmas, buttons, hair grips, etc. Unfasten and remove the inlet and outlet hoses and look for bigger obstructions there. This could, by the way, solve the mystery of the missing socks. But the trouble could be as simple as the hoses kinking as the machine is pushed back into a tight space below a work surface. If the pump doesn't spin freely and its connections are sound, it's probably had it. Disconnect, remove it, and take it to the local dealers for an exact replacement. Front doors leak because the rubber seals around them have perished. Fit a replacement. It helps to gently warm it with a hairdryer. Banshee screams or screeching during the spin cycle indicate worn or slack rubber drive belts. Don't try and adjust the tension. They've probably stretched too much. Simply replace them. The serial number is usually on the belt. However, even new belts can get greasy. Try wiping with a dry cloth. If the water in the machine remains cold, there's probably a fault in the heating element. These can be tricky to remove and expensive to replace, so you might as well call repairman. Machines that overfill usually have a faulty air pressure switch, which should automatically turn off the supply. It's usually a blockage in the pipe running into the switch. Detach and blow through it. Don't suck. Your second best friend, the tumble dryer, also suffers from blockages. The main filter, which traps lint and fluff, needs cleaning out before every session, otherwise the contraption can overheat, burning out the quite expensive heating element. This doesn't apply to condenser models. Replace broken or torn filters, or risk a load of clean washing becoming impregnated with a blowback of brownish flush, fluff and cat hairs. Squeaking machines probably have bearings which have dried out by the same hot air that dries the clothes. As long as the tension on the drive and fan belts is correct, a few drops of light oil on the bearings will work wonders. But if the bearing on the edge of the drying drum seems to be the noise source, do not oil it. If it's made of nylon, lubricate it with a light coating of PTFE spray. Lubricate a fabric bearing with just a touch of silicone grease. A dryer which runs cold is almost certainly had a thermostat failure. It's usually fixed with just a couple of screws. Undo the spade connectors and buy another one for about £3. The thermostat may have just stuck open, but if the new one similarly fails, call repairman. If the motor is running, but nothing else much seems to be happening in the way of hot air blowing, suspect a broken fan belt. Replace with the exact part number. Don't try and make do with something similar, as it may damage the machine. If a tumble dryer vibrates badly, first check there is nothing you can do to adjust the stubby legs on some models. Otherwise, the bearings are likely to need replacing at a cost. Refrigerators are usually quite trouble-free, but door seals wear out or get damaged. They are easily replaced. If power is reaching the fridge but not cooling it successfully, the first check is to see if the condenser evaporator at the back of the cabinet is warm. If it isn't, select a colder setting. Gareth Parry, writing in The Guardian. Now, I've heard that the actual sealed unit in the back of the fridge, the black thing down the bottom, is unbelievably reliable. Most definitely the most reliable thing you're ever likely to buy, because it's built to military specifications, apparently, or equivalent. Fascinating stuff. Now, something from Radio 5 about asteroids.
The American space probe Galileo has taken the closest ever picture of an asteroid. The Galileo was hurtling through space on its way to Jupiter when it took the picture of the asteroid Gaspra, which was just over 16,000 kilometers away. That's close. The first ever photo of Gaspra shows it to be 6 miles in diameter with a shape a bit like a giant shark's head. The photograph of the asteroid, which is in orbit between Mars and Jupiter, was taken using a special green filter. And after hours of painstaking research, the Formula 5 news team managed to find someone who's actually enthusiastic about asteroids. It's Dr. David Hughes, who's a planetary expert from the University of Sheffield.
Well, I find them fascinating because they are a planet that failed. You know, Mars was produced, Earth was produced, Jupiter was produced, but the big planet that was trying to be produced in the asteroid belt just didn't make it. But instead of these bits coming together and growing into something large, their orbits were stirred up by Jupiter, and they came together and smashed into each other so energetically that it just simply broke up.
That was from BBC Radio 5.
The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
5, 4...
Frequency clear.
Keep this frequency clear.
from ProSound News, a piece about secret audio in your NICAM. Delphi's Foldback Solution by Tim Frost. Television broadcaster TVAM has introduced a unique form of foldback for use with news gathering teams outside the studio. Broadcasters have a continuing battle in obtaining reliable methods of getting studio foldback to smaller mobile live links. Instructions and queue applications have traditionally used radio and mobile phones, despite patchy coverage and high usage cost. Now that NICAM stereo television coverage is available to the majority of the UK, TVAM engineers discovered that new developments in digital voice coders would allow them to fit an intelligible voice channel in the user bit area of the NICAM format. Nearly all digital formats offer a small spare area of data space for standard independent applications. In the case of NICAM, there are 11 1K bit blocks, which would normally be considered much too small an area to transmit digital sound. But Salisbury-based Delphi Systems Inc. has developed a codec DSC6400 specifically for speech that combines linear prediction with a special lookup table, which is a technique to transmit AM radio quality sound in just 5 kilobits, a compression system a dozen times more powerful than the music-based compression formats currently being developed for digital radio and Philips's DCC digital cassette system. TVAM project engineer Nick Butt took just 6 weeks from first considering the idea to fully implementing the CELP, Codebook Excited Linear Predictive, system into its NICAM transmissions. Now, all a news team needs to carry with them is a NICAM receiver with a KELP unit accessing the user data, and they have studio foldback wherever they are based in the country. Says Butt, it is reliable as a communications channel, as the NICAM signal is very robust. It is so simple that it has knocked a few people sideways. And now we are getting calls from other engineers wanting to see how it is done. That's all about Foldback from the Studio, hidden in your NICAM stereo sound, by Tim Frost in ProSound News.
Here's an interesting letter. It's from John Thorpe, Head of Development, and Robert Ellis, Technical Support Engineer, from Low Amateur Radio. They also list themselves as Senior ANORAC Consultants to Atlantic 252. Thank you for your information pack. It made fascinating reading, and we wish you well in your search for that elusive license. In line with the company's policy of we'll show you ours if you show us yours, we submit this signal report pursuant to one of your catalogues and wish you a Christmas free of ionospheric disturbances. From John Thorpe and Robert Ellis, Senior ANORAC Consultants to Atlantic 252. P.S. they write, from this you may note we take our ANORAC duties very seriously. Would it be responsible to suggest an upmarket ANORAC is a barber? Groan. Two employees from Low Electronics writing in. Thanks very much to them. And you too could write in. I look forward to receiving your letter and guarantee to read it out on air. The address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. If you'd like a reply in writing, which includes a station card, technical information, and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1. The address again, Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG.
If you're considering buying one of the Philips DC777 shortwave car radios from Radiofax Sales, here's some very good news for you. After some hard bargaining with our suppliers, we're now able to offer these terrific shortwave car radios at the new lower price of only £239. And remember, not only is the DC777 a good quality digital readout shortwave tuner, it also has long wave, medium wave, FM stereo, a high quality stereo cassette deck and powerful stereo amplifier, all in a compact, standard size in-car unit. Shortwave coverage is from 3170 to 21910 kHz continuous. This unit receives a good review in the World Radio and TV Handbook and 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. The new low price, remember, is only £239, inclusive of VAT and delivery in the UK or overseas airmail to anywhere in the world. There's no long wait for your unit to arrive. We hold them in stock. Contact our sales office for more information and a brochure. Telephone number is in England, 0483 275 997. Fax number is also in England, 0483 276 477. Or write to us at Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, GU6 7BG in England.
In America, shortwave commercial broadcasting is legal. Here's an item about it and how it's faring from Jonathan Marks on Media Network.
Just over 10 years ago, one of the first interviews I did was with Joe Costello, the owner of several radio and television stations in Louisiana, USA. He decided to put on a commercial shortwave radio station, WRNO, and at the time was convinced the 80s would be the start of a new era. A decade later, many stations like KUSW or KYOI that followed RNO's commercial lead have sold out to religious organizations. Joe Costello dropped by at our studios in Hilversum a couple of days back, and I asked him if we could conclude that shortwave is not commercially viable after all.
No, it isn't. I had a feeling at the time, in 1979, when I applied for a license. You may recall that during that period, the only other person to apply was Billy Graham, and he had applied for a station in Hawaii. That application sat at the Federal Communications Commission for years, and then my application came along, and they suddenly decided it took a lot of negotiating to push the government. There hadn't been a shortwave privately owned license granted in 40 years. But to answer your question, the commercial viability of shortwave radio is just not there. In our country, advertising is sold on the rating point system, and millions and millions of dollars in every city in the country are based on who has the share of audience. They do a small sample of 600 to 1,000 people and then project that out to represent a whole city or a whole metropolitan area, and then millions of dollars are placed on you, how you score in that sample. And to approach a buyer in New York or any other major advertising capital in the United States is... They don't understand it. At this point, Jonathan, it is not as economically viable as I thought it might be at the end of its first decade.
So you couldn't foresee this, let's say, 10 years ago?
No, I think it was a little bit of youth and exuberance. You got to understand that WRNO Worldwide was a dream of three ham radio operators. Joe Polay, Jack Bruce, and myself. We're still there today, and we're using... one 100 kilowatt transmitter with a log periodic antenna, and our beam is 20 degrees off of true north. It is not slewable, but when I did buy the antenna and chose it from an engineering standpoint, I chose it. The FCC requires a 10 dB gain in the direction of your pattern. So I bought one that had the widest predicted coverage pattern. I'm not trying to get one language into one country and using a narrow beam antenna to concentrate the power. I'm using an antenna that has a beam width almost 90 degrees wide. And as it sits in New Orleans, it follows the polar route, and it puts a great signal. It has an ERP of 3.2 megawatts, and it puts a great signal over North and South America. And then it goes over the pole to serve... Europe, Holland, we've got listeners here in Germany, everything. Mm-hmm. We average, probably by your standards, not very much, but for about a 13-person operation, by the way, I do operate three FMs, two AMs, and the shortwave, mm-hmm. all serving South Louisiana and WRNO Worldwide. So from the commercial viability standpoint of it, it hasn't been what I'd like it to be.
What sort of response do you get? I mean,
we are getting about 1,000 to 1,500 letters a month, unsolicited. You know, we do run announcements that we will QSL. We have a series of collector's edition QSL cards. Depending on what they're listening to and what they request, we send them the QSL that they want. And it's possible to get, at this point, probably 10 QSLs.
One final question. Have you had problems with the transmitter?
Because sometimes we notice the power seems to be much lower.
Well, at times, Jonathan, it is necessary to do that. You know, we don't have a standby transmitter to go. So if we're in a situation, we have a water-cooled transmitter, and there's a problem with the water that we get from the Mississippi River, and it's always corroding and things of that nature. And sometimes it's necessary to reduce the power to keep the station on the air, so that we can then service it as it goes off. Uh-huh. Another thing that has become really a problem for me is that, and I'm speaking engineering now to people who may not understand, but the finals in the transmitter are IMAX 5CX 50,000 EPs. These tubes are about $24,000 each. What happens is that they're no longer being manufactured. And what we're finding now is that we're actively scouting people who have these tubes, and we are getting them rebuilt by a company who does rebuild them. So we are able to have the tube that's on the air, which, by the way, is two of them because you have the power amplifier and the modulator. And that's the reason sometimes that it goes. It is a water-cooled transmitter. It has all the problems that you would have with a plumbing system, corrosive water. It needs distilled water. And there are times, rather than take the station off the air, we will reduce power to keep everything working.
Joe Costello of WRNO Worldwide.
All about shortwave private broadcasting in America there, with Jonathan Marks from Radio Netherlands Media Network.
Fascinating report. You're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts every Monday and Tuesday. It's our weekly review of technical, media and scientific news.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night. I should be sleeping like a log. But when I get home to you, I find the things that you do will make me feel alright. You know I work all day to get your money to buy a thing. And it's worth it just to hear you say you're gonna give me everything. So why on earth should I moan? 'Cause when I get you alone, you know I feel okay. When I'm home, everything seems to be right. When I'm home, feeling you holding me tight, tight, yeah. It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard be sleeping like a love. But when I get home to you, I find the things that you do will make me feel alright.
From the Saturday Notebook in The Guardian, Rebecca Smithers, consulting the Oracle, the Independent Television Commission's next challenge. If you thought the big carve-up of the Independent Television Network was all over, think again. After the emotional thrills and spills of the awards of the new Channel 3 television licences, the next auction on the horizon is the sell-off of Teletext, the news and information medium, which is transmitted through the television network on spare lines not used for the picture. This second tier sell-off, which will again be handled by the Independent Television Commission, if indeed it can muster the energy after the rigours of the last few months, is bound not to attract as much attention as the first. Yet, the amount of money bid for the Channel 3 National Public Teletext licence, currently held by Oracle, could be much more than what has been offered for some smaller television companies. More importantly, it is a medium which has great profit potential, with a proven commercial track record, despite a shaky start, and relatively low overheads. Oracle's profits for 1990 are expected to be around £3.5 million, on par with a medium-sized television company. The sell-off involves only the Oracle services offered on channels 3 and 4, but will also involve allocations of lines on the new Channel 5, which will be launched sometime after 1993. Oracle's license runs out at the end of 1992, along with the other television franchises. The BBC Teletext service, CFAX, which is run on BBC One and Two, will be unaffected by the sell-off. At the moment, Oracle provides more than 1,500 individual pages, including advertising, although exact capacity is difficult to specify because new technology has made it possible to use multi-pages. Because of a large regular daily viewing audience of around 6.5 million people, more than the Sun's readership, the best-read national newspaper, advertising rates are competitively pitched, with most deals booked on a series basis. Rates are generally better value than for national newspapers, given the higher readership. A single page, if shown nationally for an entire week, for example, would cost £7,500, but would qualify for discounts of up to 40% if run for up to 52 weeks. This compares with the most expensive rate of £19,000 for a prime page for one day in The Guardian. There is scope for increasing the number of viewers, as around 40% of all television sets now have a teletext facility, and the figure is expected to double by the end of the decade. So, what does the forthcoming carve-up mean for the viewer? The current operation will be split to offer a national public service and a number of unspecified additional commercial services. The public service will be the most important, offering news and other editorial information. Like television franchise applicants, the highest bidder will win, but must pass a quality threshold laid down by the Independent Television Commission. The winner will have to offer national and international news, regional information, for which the number of pages will be specified, and must offer editorial in 8 key areas, including weather, sport, travel, and educational material. The commercial additional service licenses, however, will be sold off to companies who want to distribute rapidly changing information to a target audience. So, obvious candidates are bookmakers who already use television screens, and also financial services companies who may want to offer share prices. They must specify to the ITC in advance what they intend to use the service for, but the ITC will not monitor the quality of their proposed output. Thankfully, the ITC is likely to take a dim view of those wishing to offer teletext versions of chat lines, for example. Whatever appears via the commercial services, viewers should thank their lucky stars that the original proposals in the broadcasting bill were not adhered to, due largely to active lobbying from Oracle. David Meller, then in charge of broadcasting, was persuaded to change the original plan, which was to fill the government's coffers by selling off the entire independent teletext network to commercial players with no public service at all. The change of plan means that there will be less capacity for the public service than Oracle has at the moment. There is one argument that it will force the provider to concentrate on quality rather than quantity. This could see the end of general feature material such as knitting, recipes, chess and angling, and the kids' pages, reducing the scope of advertisement sales. But the most popular sections, news, sport, business and television listings, may end up being of higher quality than at the moment. Whatever the quality offered by the new provider, however, there are still the basic criticisms of teletext itself which have to be overcome. The most common gripes are that teletext is not user-friendly, and viewers complain that it takes too long for a page to be called up. The average time to page the Oracle is 10 seconds, even though innovations such as FastText are helping speed things up. But teletext is increasingly pipping other news media at the post. Oracle made its name with fast-moving events in the Falklands War and is in dispute with CFAX over who was the first to announce the resignation of Mrs. Thatcher. So, who are the likely bidders? This is where the battle hots up even more and could be as acrimonious as the fight for the television franchises. Oracle, which trades as Oracle Teletext Limited, will, naturally enough, be applying in its own right to retain the franchise. But it faces a rival bid from Independent Television News, which currently provides news, sport and city information. The ITN board has to decide whether it should bid for the franchise after it has lost in its attempt to bid for the breakfast television franchise as part of the Daybreak consortium. Other bidders are rumoured to include IntelFax, which currently provides editorial pages for Channel 4, and the news agencies Reuters and Press Association. It is even thought that publishing groups which lost out in the scramble for the television franchises, such as Virgin, might also bid. To make matters even worse, it is understood that some ex-Oracle employees are helping rivals to prepare bids. The timetable will be a tight one. The ITC expects to ask for bids for the public licence before the end of the year, and will announce the winner next March, with a view to starting broadcasting in 1993. All about teletext licences there, on Channel 3 and Channel 4, by Rebecca Smithers in The Guardian.
Rescue.
Sent in by John Braden from Lehman in Germany is a listing from the Anarch Shortwave Listeners Net from Pennsylvania in the United States. They list us on 12255 and a few American pirates. 6240, The Voice of Tomorrow. 67410, Voice of Tomorrow also. And all on 7415, Radio Free North America, East Coast Beer Drinker, Action Radio, Defiance 90 and Radio USA. In this country, recently Radio Merlin has returned on 6240 and on 6310 Radio Dublin from Ireland has come back. It's Sparks on Radio Fax. Hello to Raimondi Danielle, who writes from Verona in Italy. He listens on 6205. With little interference and reports, our music good. Thanks very much, Raimondi.
This is from the Radio 4 Kaleidoscope program, where somebody was describing his work with a cylinder recording, which he believes has the voice of Queen Victoria recorded on it.
And I have to say that at the end of a whole morning's work, we'd still probably only got about four words out of it.
And this is what you're doing, effectively, to work out how to clean up the thing, is you are electronically filtering the sound that you've got from a tape of the original cylinder.
That's right, yes, so as to save submitting the cylinder to unnecessary strain and stress, yes.
What techniques did you use further to try and make the thing intelligible?
Well, a filtering process, which the recipe book says one off the bass and one off the treble, did not touch the audible speech as far as we could tell at all, but it did mean that you could play the cylinder much more loudly on a loudspeaker without risk of blowing the loudspeaker up.
Obviously a problem. And what eventually, when you've cleaned this thing, what is the best that you've been able to get?
The next stage, if I may put it this way, was a decision that we would have to risk playing the cylinder with a different kind of stylus. In fact, I chose one thou tip, which I reckoned would go right down to the bottom of the groove where the sound waves were, and I thought that maybe I was rattling along the top edge of the groove where all the distortion was before. So we did that, and the transfer was a great deal better again. We then listened to that tape many times, but unfortunately I was very worried at that stage because I could see that I was beginning to damage the surface of the cylinder.
How do you know you were damaging it?
In this particular case, a small amount of very light brown dust was accumulating around the stylus. It was not actually changing the colour of the cylinder at all, but something was coming off it, and so I knew that I mustn't push that my luck any further.
If it is Queen Victoria, what have you been able to establish that she says?
I would say the only thing that everybody is unanimous about is the first word, which is greetings, and the last few words, which are, I have never forgotten.
Have you finished the process? Is there anything more you can do?
It's one of my satisfactions, is that I've shot my locker. I haven't got anything else I can try, and it's very satisfying when you can actually come to the end of a job and say, I have pulled out all the stops I've got.
But although Peter might be happy that he's done his best, I'm afraid at the end of the day, still, all we're left with is this. So good luck, all you sound decipherers. The whole story can be found in Paul Tritton's book, The Lost Voice of Queen Victoria, published by Academy Books at £11.95 hardback and £7.95 softback.
I'll repeat that recording once more in case you missed it. Certainly is very indistinct.
Following the collapse of Century Radio, the airwaves in Ireland were filled with discussion of what had happened. Here's an interview with Marty Whelan from the station.
Now, Marty, you were one of the people who joined Century having left RTE. You were on radio and television on RTE. It was, if you like, a daring move for somebody in such a prominent position as yourself.
Yes.
Were you happy you took the risk? Are you happy now that you took that risk?
Well, I mean, obviously, it would be very foolish of me to say today that I'm happy I took that risk. No, I'm not happy today. I couldn't be happy today. But I had some regrets over the 2 years, mainly to do with the television. Plus, I miss some friends that I had made naturally over the years. I mean, when you're with 2FM for 10 years, it's a long time, and I had made many friends there. And I missed them, and I missed the camaraderie and all that carry on. And I missed being there. But I loved the new challenge that Century presented, and I loved what we were doing, and we were achieving something. I think we were on our way. Firmly convinced we were, and the station was making inroads. So from a personal point of view, when it comes to regrets, today I would be a fool not to have regrets, because I don't have a job today, and that's a very strange feeling for the first time in my life. So that's a very strange feeling, I needn't tell you.
Marty, over the last couple of weeks, Century FM has been widely promoting the likes of, for example, on your morning programme, giving away 6 cars, so things were starting to look bright, so it's obviously a deep shock for you.
Yeah, because if you're in that situation where you're doing cars, and we had some other major competitions lined up to happen, co-sponsorship deals, etc. So therefore you're on your way, you're being positive, and you've lots of things happening. And the audience are responding. I mean, only recently we suddenly became available to the people of Sligo and the North West region. So therefore we were getting in there. We were on our way. And then, bang, out of the blue this happened. So it's a very great shock.
Finally, Marty, what next for Marty Whelan?
Well, you have my phone number. I hope somebody else does. I don't know. I honestly don't know. There isn't a plan in my brain. I'm literally here today. The phone hasn't stopped ringing all last evening. The machine, the answering machine is full. And this morning, thank God, it's lovely that people are concerned and interested enough in me to ring up and commiserate, etc. And there have been some interesting phone calls as regards the future. So I just have to sit back and take stock now and try and decide what it is I want to do and what my options are. It really is as simple as that. But today, I think we might be cancelling that Barbados holiday.
No.
I don't think that's the one now, Adrian. I think it might be British Bay for the summer holiday.
Actually, it's a lovely part of the county as well.
Isn't it the only place to go?
Marty, thank you very much indeed for sparing the time. I know it's a difficult time for you, but thank you very much indeed for sparing the time to talk to us here.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much indeed.
Good morning.
That's Marty Whelan from Century Radio, or former Century Radio, talking to us about the demise of that radio station. This is East Coast Radio. The time now, almost 2 minutes after 11.
25 and 103 FM. East Coast Radio. News on the hour.
Good morning, I'm Fiona Carmody. The collapse of Century Radio does not mean abandoning the policy of providing an alternative to RTE, according to the Minister for Communications, Seamus Brennan. Opposition parties have criticised the government for what they called the failure of the broadcasting policy. Century ceased broadcasting at 6 o'clock yesterday evening and went into liquidation. The Independent Radio and Television Commission say that there are no meetings planned today between the Commission and Century Radio.
That was from East Coast Radio in the southeast of Ireland. Years of Radio Jackie. This LP record traces the story from early operations in fields through High Street Studios to the final close down.
Police with tracker dogs and post office detection men raided a pirate radio station in South London yesterday. Radio Jackie, which was said to broadcast for 6 hours every Sunday afternoon, was manned by about 15...
On March the 7th, 1972, Radio Jackie made parliamentary history when a tape of the station was played to a committee of the House of Commons during a debate on the Sound Broadcasting Bill. This tape, the first ever to be played in the House, was used to illustrate how commercial radio could sound if it were legalised in Great Britain.
Radio Jackie!
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 The station that fits snugly into your ear.
Radio Jackie, the sound of Southwest London. Radio Jackie, the sound of Southwest London.
This is Channel 4.
A new crackdown on pirate radio by the Independent Broadcasting Authority. But is the IBA acting in the public interest?
This is Angela Rumbold, Member of Parliament for Mitcham and Morden. As many of you will know who are regular listeners to Radio Jackie, the government has introduced legislation recently which may put Radio Jackie's future at jeopardy.
From the bustle of suburbia to the rolling Surrey Downs,
from houseboats on the river Thames to office blocks in town,
close enough to really care as Brit should always be. We're Southwest London's favourite station. Radio Jackie.
In the last 16 years, I mean, Radio Jackie's done nothing but good, and the events leading to its closure are monstrous.
These fascinating recordings with a booklet of photographs all about Radio Jackie are yours for £6. For Europe, it's £8. And with airmail to the rest of the world, £10. Order your copy now from Radio Jackie, 120 London Road, Morden, England, SM4 5AT.
A letter from Simon Mason from Hull. Dear sir, I've listened to your station, Radio Facts, on and off for the last year or so, and I really enjoy the programmes you provide, especially the Sparks feature. I'm glad that you have started to use 3910 kHz, as at my location, 12255 is inaudible and 6205 is poorly received. The reason I was prompted to write is this. My main interest in shortwave is the so-called number stations. On the 3rd of December 1991 at 7:20 UTC in the evening, On your 3910 frequency, an English female voice was repeating the number 03289 until 7:25, when it said ready, ready, 3131, and it then went into five-figure groups. It was the first time I'd heard that particular station on that frequency, although it is a common broadcast elsewhere. As it happens, a book about European number stations, called Secret Signals, the Euro Number Mystery, written by myself, is due out shortly. I will send you details when I can. Perhaps you could review it. Well, we'd love to. Please send us a review copy. Your Sparks programme that day included music by the House Martins. They live 2 miles away. My receiver is a Sony ICF 2001D using an MFJ959B tuner and 20-meter random wire. I sincerely hope you get your deserved license and are able to finance a more powerful station. You certainly deserve it. Apart from Media Network, yours is the most interesting radio-related programme. Thanks very much for that letter from Simon in Hull.
Collapse of Ireland's national commercial station Century Radio and an interview with Colm Kenny. We recorded off-air.
The amendment to the Broadcasting Bill is supposed to be published shortly. It's been circulated around the Cabinet and it's been widely predicted that some licence fee money would be diverted to help perhaps an independent news service. I mean, do you think that Century should have held on just another little bit longer?
I don't think that the changes in the legislation, first of all, will come that quickly. I think it's going to be at least the spring before that bill is passed by the Oireachtas, and I think that bill contains within it more trouble, to be quite honest. I think this idea of somehow vaguely diverting money to help pay for news and current affairs will certainly not be the solution to the problems in the private broadcasting sector. I think it's ill-conceived. I think they haven't even seriously looked at how that will be managed. If they're going to manage it through the IRTC, the Independent Radio and Television Commission, it begs many questions. To be quite honest, I think what we need at this stage is a piece of crisis management by the Minister. I think we need an immediate short amendment to the broadcasting legislation lifting the cap on RTE, which is causing immediate hardship both within RTE, to the independent producers and to the advertisers. And we need a considered response to what we have now in both radio and television nationally, which is a crisis of confidence. I think we need to carefully design legislation. We've had two rushed pieces of legislation in the last 3 years. We don't need a third one. There are things which can be done to strengthen our broadcasting sector. Jobs are being lost at the moment. There's been economic hardship caused, and we're minimising our opportunities internationally. It's a ridiculous situation, and it's extraordinary that the architect of this, Ray Burke, apparently has been promoted within the cabinet. I mean, it must mean, I think, Pat, that it's easier to run a country than it is to run a radio and television station.
You say that the expertise of somebody like Capital is needed, but yet when you look at the history of radio in the country, it's the one service on RTE, for example, both the three services, in fact, when you take Radio Nouvelle into account, where there's no importation at all. It's home-produced. Now, why do we need, therefore, since there are loads of people who've worked in radio and are working in radio, now the independents and RTE, why do you actually need to bring in people from London to tell us how we need to listen to things or what we need to be given to listen to?
I don't think you do if you're starting again from scratch. I think I was talking about Capital in the context of the inevitability of the closure of Century as it presently exists. I don't think that was necessarily inevitable. Whether or not it's desirable to have a British broadcaster involved here if you're starting again to assure franchise is a question, of course, which should be discussed. If you're not going to depend on that, then you need to more carefully design the system so that it won't fail. As it was designed, I think it had a lot of problems built into it.
Do you think that the Century people should have negotiated a better deal? I mean, one of the major costs they had was the commitment to news and current affairs at 20%, which is a very high level for a station starting out, that perhaps, based on the coverage they were achieving around the country and the audiences, that that's really where the deal should have been done. We'll give you, 2% current affairs on day one, and we promise you after 3 years you'll have your 20%. But that's the way we're going to go. They didn't do it that way. They tried to do 20% from day one.
I think this is very true. There were certainly exaggerated expectations about the entire privately owned radio and television sector in this country, but nevertheless, I think a lot is possible, and I think we should look again at the options available to us. The kind of deregulation that we have had has been very limited. It's been restricted by the government and not according to guidelines which broadcasters might set. There is actually a lot of potential for other kinds of broadcasting in this country, for community broadcasting, which was promised and never delivered. I mean, in Dublin, for instance, we have given a new meaning to narrowcasting. We have two narrow music stations and nothing else. I mean, perhaps what should happen now is that some pride be swallowed by the IRTC, that 98FM, if it's willing, take on a national service, and that different kinds of radio and television be looked at. This weekend, I know, for instance, in Dublin, we had a visit from Moses Snymer of City TV in Toronto, who couldn't believe that this city doesn't support its own TV station. He runs one of the most successful city TV stations in North America. I think that's a real possibility, that Dublin should have its own service, and we should be looking at city services, both for radio and television.
All right, but going back to the Century situation, in Britain recently in the bid for a national radio franchise, when the main bidder couldn't put the cash together, the underbidder was invited to put the cash together and launch a service, and that's exactly what's happened with the classical music service nationwide on FM for Britain. Do you think that the IRTC should literally go back to the original candidates who were vying for Century's national slot and ask one of them, or should they start from scratch and advertise the whole thing all over again?
No, they should certainly not go back, because they never, in my mind, asked the most obvious questions of the original applicants, which had to do with the kind of questions which were being asked in Britain recently, by the way, about how can you afford the sort of programming you're talking about. Mm. Basic costing was never done. People were allowed to make all kinds kinds of promises, and in my opinion, you know, the enormous mistake to go back to the underbidders, if you like. I think we have to start again from scratch, and it will require changes in the legislation before we can...
And take a more realistic look at how long it takes to break into a market which is dominated by certain people and the kind of costs involved.
That's right. I think the whole thing has to be revisited. It would be a disaster to launch back into re-advertising franchises. I think that is now inevitable, that we're going to have a new piece of legislation, and that legislation cannot be rushed. But in the meantime, we have to do something, and what I'm suggesting is an amendment to the law immediately which will lift the cap on RTE, at least to get the sector kick-started again, and then for the first time, a serious analysis by way of perhaps white paper or official report on the options which are available to us, so that we can in Ireland maximise job and economic opportunities in the radio and television sector instead of shooting ourselves in the foot.
What do you think of these murmurings from the Century Board that they are contemplating suing RTE as what had been the monopoly broadcaster?
I mean, they're entitled to sue if they wish. I wouldn't like to bet on their chances of succeeding in that action any more than their success in the radio sphere, quite honestly. But certainly they can complain. RTE is not guiltless when it comes to abusing its dominant position in the market. But nevertheless, I really think that its problems were of the government's, of the IRTC's, and of its own making fundamentally. But that's just my own opinion. These things can be decided by a court.
Do you think, finally, that anyone could have made that national network work?
Yes, definitely. I think there is room for a national network.
But, I mean, given the law as it stands, do you think if someone had taken a different approach, maybe proceeded a little more slowly?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. I do believe that it was possible, even within the confines that were set out for it. But I think that if you're re-advertising it, you should certainly look at those confines again, because I think more could be done to make it both more possible and more attractive. But yes, I do believe it could have worked.
Colin Kenny, thank you very much for joining us on the line. Dublin 616-000 is a number. We'll take a break.
That interview there from RTE.
Later in the programme, fixing your washing machine, teletext licences up for auction, shortwave in the United States, a recording of Queen Victoria's voice, and TV AM squeeze foldback audio into the NICAM carrier, and more of your letters. It's Sparks on Radio Fax.
Now we'll go to Radio Netherlands and Media Network.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Marks, and in this part of the world, we're well and truly into winter now. A great time of the year, I think, especially with all the interesting signals appearing on the wireless. In the next half hour, we'll have quite a lot of tuning suggestions for you, so do grab a pen. Some pop up as a surprise, like Radio Fax, the private station in the Irish Republic, which seems to have selected 3910 kHz as a winter frequency, in parallel with another transmitter from the same site on 6205. Both are on the air round the clock. We noted 3910 kHz last night at 1830 UTC with a fair signal here in Hilversum.
Tommy Murphy, the world of country music, Radio Fact.
Some updates now. Last week we reported that the Ross Revenge, home of the offshore station Radio Caroline, had run aground on a sandbank off the English coast. And the crew had requested assistance from the British Coast Guard. After some attempts, the Ross Revenge was pulled free and towed to the port of Dover, where the ship's been impounded by the authorities. It clearly isn't seaworthy at the moment, although two members of the Caroline organisation, Neil Gates and Steve Conway, are on board as a caretaker crew. Exactly what happens now with the vessel isn't clear, although Caroline seemed to be in contact with the Dover Tourist Board to try and turn the ship into a museum. That wouldn't be the first time they've tried to do that.
Jonathan Marks there with Media Network on Radio Netherlands.
About cricket on Radio 3, a letter in the Times from Patricia Hughes, an ex-Radio 3 presenter. Radio 3 and cricket. Dear Sir, cricket enthusiasts sighed with relief at the news that the BBC had reprieved Test Match Special. As a music lover and former Radio 3 announcer, I sighed too with despair. The BBC's decision to sacrifice Radio 3's music programmes for 32 days of cricket commentary on the FM waveband, which by next summer will be the network's only waveband, seems to me to represent a shattering loss of confidence in quality public service broadcasting. This might have been simply misjudgment, but I am wondering if it isn't a deliberate means of testing public response, which could lead to further and possibly permanent cuts. The world-renowned jewel in the BBC's crown is wobbling precariously in its setting and may be lost and gone forever if those who value it don't raise their voices loud and clear before it's too late. Yours sincerely. That letter from Patricia Hughes from Twickenham in Middlesex, published in the Times. a story here about high-definition television, Wide-Eyed and Clueless, by Barry Fox in International Broadcasting. There is only one agreed norm for the future of television. Screens will have a 16:9 wide aspect ratio instead of the 4:3 box ratio, which has been standard since electronic television services began in the late 1930s. Everything else, line scanning structure, frame and field rate, signal waveform, colour and sound coding, will continue to differ from continent to continent. European manufacturers have sensibly coined a catchy generic term, Cinevision, to replace the awkward 16:9 tag. Already, Thomson is selling its Space System 16:9 television sets on the mainland of Europe and will launch in the UK next year, though Philips will probably get there first. Nokia ITT has a 16:9 set too, but there is already a confusing technology split, and even more confusing squabbles over the best way to transmit widescreen pictures into the home. Both Thomson and Nokia think it is important to enhance picture quality by artificially doubling the number of interlaced scanning lines from 625 to 1250. Philips believes it is more important to double the scanning rate, displaying an interlaced 625 lines at 100 Hz instead of 50 Hz, in order to eliminate the flicker, which at 50 Hz is very noticeable in wide areas of white, snow or sky. Next, Philips plans a 100 Hz television set with progressive scan, where each picture is written from a full 625 lines, instead of interlaced 312.5 lines. The public had its first real taste of the 16:9 format at this year's Berlin Funkausstellung, which has been transformed from a radio show into an electronics bonanza spread over 25 exhibition halls and a wide expanse of gardens. Demonstrations at the exhibition of the two currently available display techniques of 1250 line interlaced at 50 Hz and 625 line interlaced at 100 Hz show that there is very little to choose between them. Any noticeable differences were overshadowed by the fact that all the demonstrations of domestic, non-high-definition television 16:9 were marred by poor picture quality, although demonstrators admitted that there was a problem, they could not explain why. The D2Mac and HDMac signals from TVSat were being distributed by cable round the exhibition site using 12 MHz allocations in the hyperband, which is a band around 300 to 400 MHz, within that used by German and French cable networks. This has not been used before because of fears of interference with terrestrial services. Poor terminations on the Berlin exhibition site cable network introduced short group delay echoes. To make things worse, a mechanical digger cut through the cable the day before the show opened, and the cable was clumsily joined. Whereas the digital equalization circuits in a full-blown HD TV set can compensate for spurious short echo signals, other sets cannot. So, while high-definition television demonstrations were impressive, standard definition widescreen Mac displays of the same material were not. I suspect that many visitors left the show wondering what all the fuss about Mac quality was about. Ironically, these rather disappointing demonstrations of 16:9 D2Mac coincided with the first public demonstration of PAL Plus, the widescreen version of conventional PAL, which Grundig, Nokia, Philips, Thomson and European broadcasters have been developing in parallel with high-definition television. The PAL Plus prototype gave better pictures than D2Mac. Recognising PAL Plus as a political hot potato, its designers stress that their system, which is still the size of a refrigerator, is intended only for terrestrial use and will not be ready for domestic use until the mid-90s, when HD Mac is scheduled for service. They only admit when pushed that, of course, Powell Plus could be used equally well by satellites. At the same time, politicians and broadcasters were squabbling over the European Commission's plans to force satellite broadcasters into using D2Mac. During the show, Technology Commissioner Filippo Pandolfi floated his plan for the EC to spend a billion ECUs on subsidising double illumination, that is, simulcasting all Powell programme transmissions from satellites in D2Mac. The whole debate seems like a shameless waste of taxpayers' money, as the problem was created by the EC's failure to draft a solid Mac directive in the first place, following its failure to tighten the careless wording of that directive in 1988, when Rupert Murdoch announced his plans to broadcast in PAL from Astra. And the European Parliament may very well veto the scheme, even if Pandolfi gets the legally binding memorandum of understanding he wants from the satellite industry. The common sense solution is surely for the EC to forget about a directive which forces all satellite broadcasters to simulcast all PAL programmes in D2Mac, and to stop trying to force an end to PAL by some arbitrary date. The European Commission should also stop talking about D2Mac and stop telling manufacturers what circuitry they must build in their receivers. Instead, the EC should start talking about widescreen and leave it to the broadcasters and manufacturers to see for themselves that D2Mac is not only the best technology for the format, but it is also available now. The EC could then spend some of our money, but not the entire mooted billion ECUs, to fund simulcasts of movie and possibly sports channels in widescreen format, all from the same satellite as the PAL transmissions. Virtually all film material is already available in widescreen format, and there is little to gain from widescreening news, pop music and Sky One reruns. The manufacturers could then build D2Mac circuits into any widescreen set, simply labelling them as satellite Cinevision ready. Then the public would get a taste of widescreen TV without anyone getting confused about D2Mac, PAL, HDMac, PAL Plus and 16:9. My only fear is that this pragmatic approach may prove too simple and sensible for Pandolfi and the Commission to adopt. That piece by Barry Fox, published in International Broadcasting.
Available now, a brand new Radio Caroline CD called The Legend Lives On. The CD contains 44 tracks taking you through some of the great events of Radio Caroline from the first broadcasts in 1964 with Simon D. Test transmissions from Caroline North with Daffy Don Allen. Tony Prince in 1966. Other great names like Robbie Dale, Crispian St. John, Andy Archer and Peter Chicago. One track features the female DJs through the 80s. And you'll hear too memorable Caroline commercials and jingles, and about the collapse of the highest shipborne aerial mast anywhere in the world in 1987, plus shortwave test transmissions in 89 and the raid in that year on the Ross Revenge. All this is just a tiny fraction of what you'll hear on The Legend Lives On, a new 44-track CD available at £9.99 inclusive, only from these sources. SMC, P.O. Box 53121 at 1007 RC Amsterdam in the Netherlands, and from Chris Edwards, P.O. Box 1514, London W72LL in England. Radio Caroline, The Legend Lives On.